Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 685, September 2023.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell, and in this episode, we have moved on from Superman the movie to Superman Roman numeral 2. previously on Superman, well, we'll get to that. This movie literally does begin with previously on Superman.
Right.
Previously on The Incomparable, we talked about Superman. Now we're going to talk about Superman 2, and here are the panelists, some of whom you heard previously on Superman, others of whom you did not. Erica Ensign is back, rolling with the punches. Hi, Erica.
Hi. Yes, previously I was here talking about Superman, and now I'm talking about Superman I'm going to talk about Superman.
Captain
Snell.
Thank you. Shelley Brisbane is here. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, I come from the planet Houston.
That's not true.
So
you come from the planet Houston.
Houston.
Dang, I knew I should have checked to make sure.
So close, though. It's a moon of Houston.
Just a couple hundred miles and a lot of traffic.
And David J. Lohr is here. Hello, David. Welcome to the Superman party.
Yay! Well, this was the first one I saw in the theater when it was, you know, and I expect to express fervor before I say yes, because I expect zeal before nod.
Wow.
That was a little ways to go.
Yeah, that was a long way. Anyways, but, Superman 2, previously on Superman. But before we get to that, I need to say this is a movie that it turns out, so I remember very distinctly watching this in the movie theater as well. It turns out that the production of this film was a disaster. They were going to make 1 and 2 back to back. They got so far into production that they're like, oh my God, we're never going to get a usable movie out of this. They commanded Richard Donner to finish Superman 1 and stop shooting things for Superman 2. And then when Superman 1 came out, they fired Richard Donner and said, we're just going to use your footage and we're going to hire Richard Lester, the director of Hard Day's Night, and he's going to come
Lester.
In and he's going to make Superman 2 and piece it together. And then apparently Richard Lester was like, but we must reshoot things so that I can get director credit for this film. And so they reshot things. And
so they didn't
have to pay Brando.
There's a couple things going on here. So among the messes here is the firing of the director and the replacement of the director. Another mess is that their original deal with Marlon Brando apparently was to give him a percentage of the gross of the movies he appeared in as Jor-El. So rather than pay him to use his footage in Superman 2, they didn't. and they took him out, and they brought in Superman's mom instead for those scenes, and Marlon Brando does not appear at all in this movie. So it was a mess from a production standpoint.
And another big sort of mistake they made, John Williams, after a few days of trying to work with Richard Lester, went, I cannot work with that man, and left.
Yes. Yeah, so
do you lose John Williams?
So John Williams pulled out and they basically just hired somebody to play John Williams' music.
Remember when we said nice things about the score in the Superman the movie episode?
Well, ditto here, because it's the same score because they just replayed it.
It's just different.
It's inspired by themes created by.
It's very strange. So what a mess. All of this. There is now, if you're asking, yes, there has been a Richard Donner cut Superman 2 released. It in fact even includes Marlon Brando, because the Brando estate allowed Brando to appear in Superman Returns. And as a part of that, the rights to use Brando in other Superman films were acquired, including a re-edit of Superman 2 to put back as much of the Richard Donner footage as possible. We're not going to talk about that version of the movie because, quite frankly, I haven't seen it and it's not the movie I grew up with. I am sort of fascinated to see it, but I have not seen it.
Steven watched it last night after watching the theatrical cut the night before. I opted not to, so I will only be talking about what I watched.
Expressly not talking about that version.
Here.
I have consulted my sources. It is available for people to see, but it is not the theatrical release of Superman 2 that we all know. So that it's a bit of a mess. So because of that, and because they moved a bunch of stuff around in the plot of Superman 1 and Superman 2 as a part of the quick, we got to finish Superman 1, Richard Donner. This movie has a bunch of things in it that are weirdly repetitious of Superman 1, including the entire first part of the movie, which does, Erica, it does make the credits more palatable because
sort of
throughout the credits also you see scenes from Superman 1. Hey, remember that movie that you liked from 1978? Well, let's play parts of it back just to remind you. Also, I will say that all the credits now come at jaunty angles and are a little faster, and therefore it's less boring to watch than the credits in Superman 1. But still, I'm glad that they stopped doing credits at the beginning of movies. It's really boring.
I had mixed feelings about it because honestly, I mean, if I had not watched this movie in such close succession with the first one, I think it's a great idea to do sort of a previously on at the beginning of a sequel, whether it be a book or a movie or whatever.
Sure.
I just felt like the way it was executed was not great. It was like a really bad 80s sitcom sort of previously on, and the choices that they made and the way, like, if I hadn't seen the first movie, some of those clips would not have helped me at all. So I feel like in order to really thread that needle, you need to show things in a way. And I think modern television, a lot of shows do that really well right now. Show enough that even if you didn't see the previous episode, you kind of get the gist of what it was enough to go in. This was not that. And it just went on forever again.
Well, that was the thing. It was strangely repetitious. Everything was at random, so it was like, why did you choose this clip? Why do we need to see the naked little boy again? Why do we need to see this? Why do we need... And then it just kept going. I think it was like 5 minutes long. I don't know.
Yeah, and they're not focusing on things that you're going to need for the movie. I mean, there are a few things that call to mind Superman 2, but not a lot. And of course, I saw, like Erica, I feel about the same way Erica does about it. I just saw Superman, so I get the clips that they used and the like. I don't particularly care for clips that are just the visuals and not like, you know, God forbid we should do scenes literally previously on and have three or four scenes, but at the same time, just the visuals without any sort of story stuff. If you haven't seen Superman in, say, a couple of years, because this is at 1980 and that's 1978, it's not all that helpful.
It's just trying to, you know, like, it's a weird kaleidoscopic kind of like, things happen in Superman you may remember. Also, remember that Superman, the motion picture, begins with the sentencing of General Zod and his two cronies to the Phantom Zone, which we get again here. Also, they are committing a crime by, I don't know, tiptoeing into some place and then being captured, which is the least dramatic.
Right. What did they do? They didn't remind us of that.
Tiptoed into a place.
Right. It wasn't even in the first movie, so I was really confused by that. And the sentencing was not quite exactly the same.
Not
like,
the
they
same.
Didn't say the same thing. So it wasn't really previously on. It
That's
was
right.
like retconningly on.
Yeah. No Brando.
Yeah. And basically, Jaws comes in and twists some guy's neck, and then they immediately are lit up and captured.
Yep.
It's like, okay.
Yep.
And yes, I'm going to call him Jaws for the whole movie.
Okay.
Or the whole show.
Was he the voice of the shark in the Spielberg film?
Yeah, he was the voice of Jaws in the Bond film.
No, that's not. That's not. No. No. So, okay. This is a weird movie already. All of these sorts of things. I'm also going to point out, like, we talk about other differences between. One of the things I really liked, and if for you who did not listen to our episode about Superman, we didn't like it. We didn't think it was very good, although it has some nice parts in it. We didn't love it. Shelley was more measured with her criticism than the rest of us were.
Indeed.
But one of the things
but not
that
a super fan, not an apologist by any
ironically,
means.
Ironically, super fan. Hmm?
Right.
Not having been on that one and having seen Superman after Superman 2. Yeah, it even at the time, it was sort of like, gee, this should have been really good, but it has great things in it.
I have good memories of it. And the point was like, the things I remember were the only good things in it, and the rest of it I suppressed. But what I wanted to say about Superman 2 is one of the things I liked about Superman 1 was that gritty 70s, dirty, smelly, scummy New York that was Metropolis. And here only I watched this movie and I was like, wow, this Metropolis stuff, a lot of it seems really boring and doesn't have any of the flavor of the others and the way it's shot and the way it's lit. And it turns out then I discovered they mostly shot it on a soundstage, which they didn't do for the first movie, the city stuff. And that's why it seems flat, is because it was fake. And it does not have that gross New York 70s grit that was a nice character in Superman, I thought, Metropolis was like that.
Everything seems to take place on the exact same block.
Well, because they only had the one.
Right. How many times do you see the Omni sign and the JVC?
Yes.
And that guy selling fruit.
Yes. Yeah. Fruit cart. There's always a fruit cart. It always gets overturned. Also, I'll point out that because I had to look this up because it's very clear that this is true. But I wanted to look it up. That yes, indeed, Superman 2, a movie theoretically for children, was the subject of tens of thousands of dollars of product placement for Marlboro cigarettes. They designed a truck with the logo on it. There are no Marlboro delivery trucks, apparently, because that's when the gangsters know to rob your truck. So they don't put labels on them. And it's throughout. There's a billboard. There's a pack of them on Lois's desk. Like in the first movie, apparently there was a more under the table kind of, they supplied them cigarettes for Lois Lane. In this movie, no, it was, let us write you a check, and in return, no more of those lines about lung cancer. Seriously.
Yep.
Yeah, so, I did notice, boo. Like, there's a nice close-up of, like, she's just smoking like a chimney.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it wasn't even just Marlboro, because there's, like, the Coca-Cola sign.
Oh, yeah,
and
there was
I just
a lot
felt
of product
like it was,
placement.
This was way more.
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
But that made me hungry.
But the one, like, for a movie, it's for the kids. And I'm like, wow, amazing. So that's not cool. And that was on that fakey soundstage, too. There's like Superman falls into the Marlboro truck at one point.
I was amused that within all the product placement, the bus had this big banner for Evita, the Android weapon.
Yes, that's right.
Which, that's a little weird, but okay.
Uh-huh. I mean, why not? I mean, not everything's product placement. Some things are just strange.
I actually happened to have been in New York in the summer of 1980 and remember Evita being everywhere.
Like, oh, yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
How do we make this feel like New York? Or, I mean, Metropolis, but it's just New York. We all admit it's just New York. So, lots of things about this movie are weird and connected to the fact that it was sort of shot and then reshot around the first movie and after the first movie and all of that. And apparently, if you look and you're a continuity kind of person, you can tell, like, literally in the same scene, the actors look different from shot to shot sometimes. I don't really pick up on that. I'm kind of going with the storyline. It's fine. Whatever. I get reshoots happen. It's fine. Mm-hmm.
The one scene where I really noticed it is the final scene where
Lois's hair keeps changing.
Lois have their thing. The hair keeps changing. Their complexions keep changing.
Yeah, there are
it's
a couple.
A little disturbing.
There are a couple.
Well,
of
he
scenes.
Lost Gene Hackman at some point,
yes.
So he's got stunt doubles and his voiceover from somebody else.
Yeah, yeah. There's several moments where it's like, why is Lex standing with his back to the camera? And the answer is because that's not Gene Hackman. Mm-hmm. It's covered fairly well, but once you know,
right. It's not egregious. I read it after I had seen it, and I honestly didn't notice when I was watching because there were so many other things to notice.
Well, and I was going to say, speaking of like voiceover, like replacing things. There's one guy in that country town, the guy who goes like, girl or no girl, we're going to talk or whatever. I would swear that's Lance LeGault's voice.
Could be.
I've seen so much Magnum and so much A-Team. That has to be Lance LeGault.
I mean,
I can't find any proof of it.
Do some looping. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this plot of the movie, I would argue, is, I mean, it's a, in some ways,
it's a plot.
I think there's a lot, But in some ways, I think if I can summarize it, I think it's more complex and interesting and a little less silly than the plot of the first movie. Because the plot of the first movie is really, all right, there's a planet that goes on for a while. And it's like, okay, then there's a kid and that goes on for a while. And it's like, and now he's in Metropolis and he's Superman. It's like, finally, right? And then there's a guy with a plan to launch nuclear missiles and make beachfront property. Okay, fine. But this the idea here is that there's an opening, James Bond-esque, I would say, opening scene where terrorists have an H-bomb at the Eiffel Tower and Lois is sneaking into the Eiffel Tower, like, using the barest minimum of subterfuge, like, look over there. And then she runs into the Eiffel Tower. Superman saves the day. He throws the H-bomb into space. Hooray. But space being a very small place where everything is right next to one another, shatters the explosion of the H-bomb, shatters the containment of the Phantom Zone. Thereby
I think it got caught in the wake of the meteor, years ago. And
Clark's the space spaceship. Wake. Oh, we can headcanon this thing. Erica, even with that, many years later, if they're floating around in space, they happen to be right by where the nuclear explosion is. Okay.
It's a very precise wake.
It just made me laugh. It's like, oh, sure, of course it's there. Space isn't big enough for it not to be there. Space is not one of the larger things in the universe, you know. It's actually quite small. So they're released, these villains from the Phantom Zone, Kryptonian villains, and under the yellow sun of Earth, of course, they've got all the Superman powers. So that's bad. They do some shenanigans for a lot of the movie. They go kill a bunch of astronauts on the moon. They go to a little
Can I ask my question about the Houston thing there?
Yes.
Okay, so they say Houston, but why? Because don't they know that word because they heard the guy saying Houston, have a problem?
Right.
So
you would think.
Well, because there's no air on the moon, so they didn't hear it very well. But they did hear it.
But then they can talk.
I let that pass because you could hear something in a language you don't speak. Of course, they speak English perfectly for the rest of the movie. And you could make a mistake like that.
Yeah. You're right. It's one of those things where they hear it and yet they don't perfectly repeat it. But it is.
It
does lead to, I think, a very funny joke, which is that they think the planet is named Houston because all the astronauts are saying, Houston, Houston, there's people killing us up here. Houston. So they do that and they go to. So there's this whole side plot for a long time in the movie where the super people are very, very, very slowly making their way from space to the moon, to the outer reaches of Texas, to eventually the White House. It takes a long time for them to get there. Meanwhile, Clark and Lois have been set on a cute trip to Niagara Falls to uncover some
Canada!
Sort of Niagara Falls scam. Big Canadian flag. I thought of you, Erica.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of CanCon in the first one because, the Kansas was actually Alberta. Oh, I also forgot to mention that my friend Chris from the Radio Free Scarrow podcast, his grandpa was the engineer that drove that train. It was in the first movie.
Oh.
So a little bit of CanCon. So then as soon as Niagara Falls popped up again, I was like, sweet, a little bit more.
So does the Can in CanCon stand for Kansas or Canada?
Yes.
Oh, gasp.
It depends on.
It's both.
Yes, yeah. The answer
is CanCon. It's what it is, Erica. CanCon. You heard it here first. So, yes, they're in Niagara Falls. Hooray for Canada. They're going to blow the lid off of this hotels exploiting honeymooners with scams story.
You have to pay so much extra for those pillars that are made of like lava lamp. I would get scammed for those. I would absolutely take that.
Also,
scam.
Poor Lois Lane, who was while she was hanging from the Eiffel Tower elevator, thinking I'm going to win the Pulitzer Prize. Now she's in Niagara Falls, finding out about honeymoon scams.
Yeah, she actually says Nobel Prize, which is not a thing journalists can win.
Right.
No.
Yeah, right.
But this strange hotel room, this honeymoon suite they go to, it's like something out of a Blake Edwards movie.
Yes.
It's
amazing. I was waiting for the doors to open and the farce to begin.
Yeah.
But the farce
or Dudley Moore's bedroom in Foul Play.
The farce is that, Lois and Clark have to pretend to be together. And of course and I like the emotional baggage of this because this is the whole idea of like, oh, I can't reveal my true identity to her. I love her, but she loves Superman and I am Superman, but I can't tell her. Like, that's kind of funny, and yeah. I thought it's not handled in a gross way. I mean, he does sort of sit on the bed and say, "We've got to talk about the sleeping arrangements," and her response is, "Well, it's very simple. You'll sleep on the couch," and he's like, "Wah wah," right? Like, okay, I'll do that. But anyway, a dumb kid does shenanigans on the bars, on the other side of the bars, and falls to his death at Niagara Falls. But no, Superman, who happens to be passing by, saves him, which leads Lois to think, you know.
Hey.
I like how long that whole thing took, though, because he got up on the bars and then he goes down in the water, and it seems like it takes forever for Superman yeah, to arrive. Of course, Superman has the gift of time travel, as we found out last time.
He does. Also, it just seems like it takes forever because time stops when you're in the moment of terror as a child is falling to
their
death.
Sure, yeah.
That's probably what it is, right? So anyway, also Clark had to clean off his glasses from the splash from Niagara Falls. And she's like, hey, wait a second. Like, that was suddenly the big idea. Anyway, Lois gets the idea, you know what? I think Clark Kent is Superman. And he's like off buying her a hot dog or something. And he's like, oh, hot dogs, Lois. I got you some hot dogs. She's like, I don't believe it.
And orange juice.
Yeah, and orange juice, of course. I don't believe it. You're Superman. You're really Superman. And she's like on the case now.
That is a lovely plot line, though. I do enjoy that because it is. You've always been like, they look alike.
Yeah.
Come on. And one thing I realized, I don't think I've really watched one of these in probably over 40 years. And when he's doing Clark, especially in the beginning and at the end, his voice, it's like Gary Berghoff doing Kermit the Frog. It's kind of amazing.
We said
very Kermity.
His voice, and Christopher Reeve does some great stuff with his posture.
Oh, yeah,
when he's Clark Kent, like it's not just the face
the
with the glasses on it. There's more going
on.
You can see it more
in this movie than I think we all admired how he did it in the previous movie. In the previous movie, you sort of have more Superman acting as a human than Clark Kent. The Clark Kent bits are not that extensive. In this movie, you get more Clark Kent. And I would argue that his Superman, where he's adjacent to Clark Kent, is, and I'm not even talking about the weakened Superman, but he is a little less Superman and a little more Clark Kent, even in those parts of the movie.
I
don't think it's bad, but you can sort of see them as more the same than I think in the first movie, where there is some sort of transformation that goes on between Clark and Superman in the first movie that is a little less bright. The line is a little less bright in this movie.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So in the end, what happens is that she's got this whole plan. She's going to just jump into the water and head for the falls. And
that's cold.
And he's going to have to save her.
I was going to say, I'm sure that's not cold at all. And what's she wearing? Like,
he uses his heat vision to drop a branch. And it's like, Lois, get the branch. And she gets the branch and he comes down and she pulls him in the water. And Superman didn't come and it's fine. Ha ha. He finally did it. And then, of course, when they're back drying off at the honeymoon suite, he trips and falls and puts his hand in the fire. And
oddly placed fire.
And is unscathed, at which point she realizes it. And she says, I think, what I was thinking, which is, this is essentially self-sabotage, right? You must have subconsciously wanted to reveal yourself here because of all the times, we know you're not really clumsy, of all the times to do this. So the cat is out of the bag. So we other have this whole other big storyline, which is Clark has revealed himself to Lois, and they're in the perfect place for it, the honeymoon suite in Niagara Falls. But he takes her to the Fortress of Solitude and shows him about his history as an alien who lives in a little crystal house.
I have a quick question about
the
Fortress of Solitude. In the first movie, was it not in Antarctica as opposed to the Arctic?
No, it was in the Arctic.
I would have to check
it. No, it was in the Arctic.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Because some reason I remembered that it was Antarctica. Okay. Pardon me for interjecting my own errors into the movie.
Probably also Canada, honestly, since the North Pole
let's just assume it's Canada.
The North Pole is essentially ocean, so it's probably just the far reaches of northern Canada that he's going to.
Absolutely.
And I mean, a Fortress of Solitude in the Arctic was ripped off from Doc Savage.
Yeah. Oh, just well, saying. Take that, Schuster and Siegel, or whoever wrote that story.
I think it was after them. No, they didn't create the Fortress of Solitude.
Right. But. Take that, DC Comics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all right. So the here's a part of the plot I have a problem with.
And so he takes her from a tacky honeymoon suite to a really elegant one. Look at it that way.
The Fortress of Solitude?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Sure. So, all right. So the key part of the plot here is, for reasons, and I have a lot of issues with these reasons. I actually love, just to reveal what I think about this movie, I actually really love a lot of the details of the movie. I don't love the reasons why the details happen. And so here we are, which is he has his interactive AI-based, crystal-based thing, database that doesn't show Marlon Brando, because otherwise he's going to come for money, but shows his mom.
I mean, Marlon Brando takes a lot more operating memory, so
to run that. So it's talking to his mom, or the virtual representation, and one of the things that he says is, "I'm in love with Lois Lane, and I want to be with her." And his mom says, "Well, if you want to be with a human woman, and I strongly advise against it, stand in this chamber and lose all your powers, and then you can live among the humans." I have issues with this. Yep. Why? Why is it necessary to not be Superman if you're in love with Lois Lane? No reasons are given. Just, Emily, it's like she's answering the question. Maybe the database is very limited. It's like she's answering the question, "I've decided to be human and not be a super person anymore. Can you help with that?" But that's not what he's asking. He's just saying, "I would like to be with this woman who I love." And her response is, "Step into the chamber that removes your powers." I don't like it.
And of course, he makes that decision very quickly without consultation with anyone, including this woman he loves.
And nor do we really parse the issue here, which is, I am the protector of the Earth. And if I make this decision, surely nothing bad will ever happen that I will regret not being able to stop because I'm Superman. There's not even a chance. There's a chance for kind of a moral dilemma here. None. There's none. Just
right, because he was given that when he went to the Fortress of Solitude in the first place, he was basically given this great commission. This is why you exist. This is why you're here on Earth. And whether it's because Marlon Brando isn't there to reinforce it or whatever, you don't want your powers anymore? Okay, honey, just get in the fortress and then you can be with Lois.
Marlon Brando would never have let that happen. That's all I'm saying. Because the big problem I have with that, aside from no reasons given, right, the whole thing, they repeat this multiple times in the scene. You know, if you step into that chamber, there is no going back. You will lose them forever. There is no way to reverse this. Nothing you can do will reverse this. And eventually, I mean, you know, it's Superman. He's going to have to get his powers back. No explanation as to how he did it. Just, you know, all of a sudden he shows up.
It's because a green crystal landed underneath Lois's bag and therefore did not get blown up while the thing went...
I guess, but...
Yeah, but they do it off a screen. And the original idea was... apparently the original idea from the Donner Cut was that a Jor-El was going to appear and do the, like, reach out with his finger and touch him and, like...
Oh, right. The Dawn of Man, or
yes,
whatever.
But they're not. Mm-mm. They no Marlon Brando again. Yes, he'll take 10%
of the
gross.
Can't do that.
So we can't allow that, and so it's never answered. So I feel like one, this is a missed opportunity for the movie. It's never explained, and here's missed opportunity number two. When they get back to civilization, or what passes for it, a diner with a mean truck driver,
by walking apparently.
But yes, they discover.
I was going to say that's the greatest super feat of the whole movie is that after he's lost his powers, they manage to walk all the way from the Arctic
from Northern
to this
Canada.
Diner.
Well, they get a car at some point.
Well, yes, but even
they drive up to the diner. But where was the car? They stole it.
Ice Road Truckers helped them out, and also I think it's like Elf, right? Like he walks all the way from the North Pole, and he's just the swirly whirly gumdrops,
and they're dressed appropriately for Northern Canada, and it's fine.
Take a ride on a narwhal, you're fine. You'll get there. So all of those things happen.
This is why Niagara Falls wasn't cold,
and this leads to my even more frustration with this story, which is they find out that Zod and company have come to Earth. and have reduced the, you know, had the president has knelt before Zod in a fun scene that I really like. And Terrence Stamp is great as Zod. And he's just just taking kind of delight in being a bad guy. But there's no, it happens instantaneously. It's literally like, what a unfortunate coincidence that the one moment that you decided to give up your powers was literally the moment when three Kryptonians came to Earth and took it over. Wow, bad luck for you. And I can't help but thinking, wouldn't this have been a more interesting movie if Lois and Clark had been given time together so that he would have to have a horrible sacrifice to make in order to give up his humanity and become Superman? What if, for example, and I'm just spitballing here, the whole idea was that Lois's memory of him as Superman would be erased when he went into the chamber, and that it would be erased again, the memory of their time together would be erased, or something like that. A horrible sacrifice is what I'm saying. What if there was more of a sacrifice here? But instead, they, like, the worst sacrifice is that they had to take that ride from the ice road truckers, and they had to walk a long way.
And my speaking of the sacrifice itself, one of my annoyances was when they get to the truck stop and that guy is giving him grief. Like, previous to this, Clark Kent had been kind of clumsy, and he was maybe not quite as bright as Superman. But whenever Superman was Superman, he seemed like he had it together. He had been learning things on the entire trip all the way from Krypton to here. And suddenly, like, he knows he has given up his powers because he wants to be with Lois, and they walked all that way or drove, and they get hit there, and this guy starts giving him grief, and he challenges him to a fight. Like, suddenly Superman is holding the stupid ball, and there's no good reason for it, because okay, he's not Superman anymore. We're part of your powers, like the ability to rationalize and, like, reason. I don't know. Right. It was weird.
And by the way, I believe that Erica has adopted the Susanna York pronunciation of Krypton rather than Krypton.
I did that on purpose. Yes.
Well, I'm glad you did.
It's not just her. It's everybody in the first movie too.
Right. It's Oregon, not Oregon. Right. It's Oregon.
Right. Yeah.
Only the outsiders say Oregon or Krypton.
Yeah. I'm hip with the Krypton lingo.
It's all Kangkangkon. Forget it. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It's like Clark being a bumbler was an act. Does the Red Sun turn him into an actual bumbler? I kind of don't believe that. I think the movie hasn't really thought it through, and maybe Christopher Reeve and his director or directors didn't really kind of think through the, like, what is post-Red Sun removal, Yellow Sun and removal, whatever it is, Clark / Superman, who is he? Who is that guy? Because he doesn't act like Superman or Clark, right, in picking that fight
and
getting beat up.
And it would be important to sort that out, because, the tension earlier in the movie is that Lois is in love with Superman, but she's interacting with Clark. So who is she in love with?
Yes.
And is she in love with this third person?
Right. And that's what Lauren said while we were watching. She was like, wait a second. You're in love with Superman, and the solution is to kill Superman so only Clark Kent remains? What?
And she literally says, I want the man I fell in love with. And we're just like, ooh.
And this is what I say. I like the details. I like the moral dilemma. Yep. I like all of that. It's the
execution.
It's the execution that kills me. Cause it's like, this is such a great idea for a story of a sacrifice and giving, what would you give up? Either need to give up being a hero and helping people in order to find love, or you need to give up love in order to be a hero. It's a very, dare I say it, Spider-Man kind of tension there.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking it was very Spider-Man. Also, the thing is, I think it would be super interesting. Gotta quit doing that. I think it would be very interesting to see Superman as Superman wrestling with that dilemma before he makes a sacrifice, because we see how Lois feels about Superman, but we don't really know how Superman feels about Lois, other than he's protective of her to the exclusion of many other people, especially in the first movie. What does love mean for Superman? Why is he willing to give it up for Lois?
Yeah, especially since he's taken great pride in being the protector of the people of the Earth, and he knows that by doing this, lots of people are going to die who would not have otherwise died. So it's quite the whole thing is a little bit baffling, and yet such a great, it's one of these things where it really comes down to the pitch for this movie is a great pitch. And then the detail work in the storyline kind of invalidates so much of the pitch that it's too bad.
At every turn. Like, just from the very beginning, like, I think it was a great idea to do some of the previous Leon, but the execution completely fails.
Well, and, you know, on the writing side, you have Mario Puzo again, who I don't think quite gets comic books.
Yeah, he wrote apparently like a 500-page screenplay, and then they brought in the Newmans to rewrite him, and then they brought
Tom Mankiewicz.
They brought in Tom Mankiewicz as creative consultant because he didn't get a script credit, but he's the one who ended up writing the scripts for these films.
And he wrote some of the not great Roger Moore Bond films, which that's what he's famous for.
Yeah, that's why that Paris thing feels so Bondy.
Well, I swear Clifton James is in this as a sheriff. I think he's supposed to be the sheriff that was in Live and Let Die and The Man with the Golden Gun, Mankiewicz wrote.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
It's very peculiar. I do, again, I enjoy General Zod and the villain kind of buildup.
They're great.
I like the
and
scene.
Ursa is great.
I like the scene in the Western town. I like the scene. I like the guy in the boat who watches them and just is like, I'm just going to stay in my boat.
Right? I think they're great inhabiting the characters. I think their dialogue is funny.
Yes.
Both to each other and to the humans. It's campy and silly and ridiculous, which, you know, we could talk about sort of how that goes through the whole movie. But I think in terms of the way those villains appear and everything that they do, the performances and the writing of their dialogue, it's great. I love it.
Yeah. I also like, I like how Lex Luthor is used in this movie. First off, he escapes from prison on a balloon flown by Miss Tessmacher, but they leave poor Ned Beatty behind in a fat joke. He's too fat. He holds down the balloon.
He's ballast.
But that is how they treat poor Otis throughout all of these movies. So be it. Anyway, they go and they find the Fortress of Solitude and they kind of pilfer it and they look around it and all that. But what I really like about Lex Luthor is that he shows up at the White House for General Zod and is like, I can help you out. And they're like, kill him. He's like, no, I got a plan. And he does his fast talking thing and he's like, I can get you Superman. I know who Superman likes. He's the son of Jor-El. And they're like, oh, I need my revenge on Jor-El. And he's like, yes you do, right? Like he's just trying to do whatever he can. He knows he's playing a very dangerous game with three people who could just rip him apart if they wanted to, but like, this is what Lex is good at. He does the fast talking and it leads to that moment at the end of the movie where Superman says to Lex, you've got to get him into the thing here because we can turn him back into human, knowing that Lex is going to immediately betray him, which he does. And then, but he's reversed the polarity of the neutron flow. So now the red light comes on the outside instead of the inside. And Lex afterward is like, oh, you know, and I know that I was going to betray you. It was all part of the, and it's just like, that is to me, that is like really good use of Lex Luthor and of Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor. And I like him way better in this movie than, he's fine in the first movie, but here, because he's so Weasley, I kind of love it.
I famously did not like him in the first movie, and that was one of the first criticisms that I mentioned. In this movie, I really do like him, and one of the reasons I do is that for Lex Luthor to work, he has to have gizmos and gadgets and things and plans and stuff. He has none of that in this movie. He's escaped from prison. Somehow he manages to get a suit, and he manages to go all over to the places he needs to go, including the Fortress of Solitude.
And he gets hair.
Ice Road Truckers.
He's just a middle-aged guy with a good line, and he's fighting these four superheroes really, and he manages to stay alive through it, which is really entertaining.
He does have one gizmo though. He's got the thing that he somehow managed to build while he was in
black
prison.
Box, right.
So
his hologram generator.
But he also has the thing that detects the alpha waves.
Oh yes. Yeah.
That's the thing. Yeah, that's
Superman detector.
But yeah, in the first movie, he's just not a compelling villain. He's just
no, he's
goofy.
I really hated him in the first movie.
He's just a goofy guy with a real estate scheme, right?
He's not really a compelling villain here either. He's really just like, he's the comic relief. And I feel like I didn't like him a ton in this movie because like it just went a little bit too far because he is so high on his own supply that he just believes that he can't, which I mean, I guess that's why he shows up and how he gets there in the first place.
That's what you have to do to become a supervillain. Yeah. I mean, think about it.
Just so much, like so close, so close. And I don't mean he, like Hackman's fine. It's just, if they would have sort of dialed it down just a titch, I think it would have been perfect for me. It was just a little too much.
Yeah, like it was too much for me, but I like him in this because he's not the villain. He's not on the peripheries, and you need a real villain to face Superman.
He's like, let me help the villains out. And you're like, wait.
The villains don't need him. And he's trying to find himself a place. He's trying to stay alive, but he's also trying to find a place for himself in this villain hierarchy.
President,
he's essentially
of Australia.
Otis in this movie, or less than Otis, because he's, you know, following the round, Mr. Villain, Mr. Villain. I mean, it's ridiculous, and I love it.
Honestly, the moment, I dearly love the moment where Zod finally sees his worth and says, so... King of Australia or whatever he says, President of Australia.
Right. Yep.
He's like, and Lex is like, finally, right. I got through to him. It's a very good moment. I think so. I mean, I like this movie. I think it is better than the first one. I just am so bugged by the missed opportunities to have some really good, like a modern, look, we talked about how these are some of the earliest superhero movies, and they led to movies that led to movies that led to now, when they're all superhero movies. This is one where a modern version of this movie probably does this right. I mean, Spider-Man 2 is kind of a modern version of this movie a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's got that similar kind of like pathos to it, and the torment of the hero and all of that. It's a little different, but it's a similar kind of thing. It's a mess and they don't get there, but there's a lot of stuff like that they're dealing with these issues at all, and that he has to make a choice and he has to make a sacrifice. And there's that sad moment at the end where Lois magically, through a magic kiss, I guess, not explained, doesn't remember anything about it. However, the fight, whenever these people are fighting, it's super boring because they're all super people. Just like in Man of Steel, where Superman fights Zod, and it's boring because they're both perfect and therefore can never do anything but destroy everybody who isn't them. But
so move it underground, and then it's hilarious.
That is kind of an inspired moment where everybody goes underground and the people are just standing there as the ground rumbles.
That's a way better way to do it than having just punch each other.
That's fun. Yeah, I have in my notes, you'll believe that three men and a woman can fly again and again and again and again.
The flying is not as graceful as it is in the first movie either.
No.
It is interesting during the fight how many implements they all have to use, because, you know, if you're going at each other with all the super beings, you have to have, you know, giant edifices of some kind that you can throw at one another or hit at each other with.
Right. It's like the
point. Which is kind of interesting, but it makes it look really clumsy.
Yeah.
Like, right. Like it's clever in the sense that you're like, well, how would super people fight? I guess this is one way they would, but it ends up being clumsy. And I think that, and I'm somebody who cannot comment intelligently on special effects or their quality, but you know, all this is fake and it looks fake, and to me even, and it's just fakey McFakerson. It's bad.
Yeah,
It's funny. I had such fond memories of it, but like I said, I haven't seen it since 1980. And when I watched the trailer the other night, and I just got that sort of cold feeling in the pit of my stomach. It's like, oh no.
No, it's much more interesting when they get to the Fortress of Solitude and it's a mental game, right? Which I think is the whole idea with this is, how do you take, okay, you've got super villains who are invulnerable and perfect, and you have a superhero who's invulnerable and perfect, and you can see as a writer them looking at this and going like, what do I do with this? And the answer is what they did, right? They make the super,
it's a good answer,
they make Superman give up his powers for the woman he loves, and then he has to go through a trial in order to get it back. There's the whole like the mental game that happens at the end where they're like, oh, we're gonna get our revenge on Jor-El by turning turning you into a human and making you our slave and all that. And he outwits them, right? Because they punch each other. It just goes on forever, but he can outwit them. They do use the people at the Daily Planet as hostages, but that's sort of like, how would you get Superman to do what you want? Like, that stuff I find really interesting. The obligatory and not very, like in the Marvel movies, you have the obligatory fight scenes, and the DC movies, even all the Marvel super or modern superhero movies are like that. And they can be real boring, right, Erica?
Oh boy.
It just gets to punchy punchy.
But when it's when there are emotional stakes, then you're like, oh, right. Yeah, that's why I care about these characters. And this movie has it's dawning on this movie as it's being written, like, oh yeah, this is how we do this. And so that last moment with Lex, and he's like, no, Lex, we got to get him into the thing. That's a better kind of like battle, because of course the bad guys are then led to their defeat by Lex. Also, they all just kind of get pushed off into oblivion and they're never, like, do they live in the basement of the Fortune of Solitude now?
Yeah. What happens, right? Are they dead? What is dead for super
well,
people?
If they're mortal, they're mortal now, so.
Maybe?
Or
are they
just
maybe? Do we know that?
Or are they just hanging down and hanging around in the basement?
We don't know.
I mean, there are more Superman movies.
So here's the thing that bothered me about that. And then the eventual amnesia ending. Is that, you know, okay, so he's reversed the polarity and the red sun of Krypton affects everyone in the rest of the fortress instead of him. So, yeah, it affects the Kryptonians. What does it do to the two humans? What if that had caused Lois's amnesia? That would be something that makes sense.
Again,
I mean, certainly better than a non-consensual mind wipe. Why do all
exactly.
of these cute alien men from other planets have to keep non-consensually mind wiping their female companions that I like?
Her brain just couldn't retain it. the awesome. I mean, again, yes, if that had all happened at the Fortress of Solitude, but I suspect we've got a when did the reshoots happen reason here,
yes.
Which is why that happens at the Daily Planet in her office instead of being like the fallout. And also, again, Erica, you said non-consensual. This is maybe one of those things where there could be some emotional personal drama in him saying, Lois, you can't know that I'm Superman, and her agreeing to it tearfully.
That would be a totally
right?
Lois Lane kind of moment.
Right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then they can have the whole conversation about his choice and why he's making it, and she could even participate in
and
that
agree.
Choice with him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that scene, as it is, does have some great dialogue and just
sure.
a great yeah. connection between them, but that would be so much better.
Right? Right?
You know.
And yep. again, it's all about the execution. Like the idea, I think the ideas in Superman 2 are top-notch, like superhero movie ideas. I really do. I think that, and my memory of it, honestly, again, like the first movie, a little bit is that I suppressed all the details that don't work. And I just remembered the arc. And then I watched it and I was like, oh, right. It doesn't actually make sense, even though there are so many good bits in it. And I after we did the Superman episode, I heard from people who are like, oh, you just don't like it because it's old or whatever, which is like, there are lots of movies made around this time that are in a very similar genre that are great and hold up, and Superman did not. And this is similar, but I will say this. They didn't know how to make superhero movies back then. They were new. Like, how do you even try to make a superhero movie? And Superman 1, the archetype is one of those really boring origin story movies that thinks, hey, everybody loves the superhero, so rather than telling a story about them, we'll tell the story about how they came to be. We don't want to see it. We don't want to see it. We just want to see the superhero. Superman 2, though, is like, in its plot synopsis, it's a good superhero movie. It really, it gets it. It's in the execution where a lot of the details are like missed opportunities that kind of fall apart, but it was one of the first, so I get it.
I do want to see the origin story. I love origin story movies, and I don't care who knows it. But as we talked about last time, I was bummed about how poorly they did with the origin story, so we didn't really even get it. So I do feel like this is a better movie. Superman 2 holds together as a movie. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end, it has a plot.
It does.
As opposed to everything, like, you know, feeling like three different bits of a serial shoved together like the first movie. But I feel like I cared about this one less. And I think that that does boil down to the execution, because I just couldn't quite buy in to the things that I did care about, because the reasoning just wasn't quite there. I enjoyed the bad guys are so fun in this movie. It's so much better than Lex Luthor in the previous movie, even though I liked him better in the previous movie. It's just it's really complicated how up and down my feelings about these two movies go, because I think this is a better movie, but I think I cared about the first one more because the bits that I remembered from the first time I saw them I think they are higher than the heights that this movie reaches when it's even at its best.
And I don't know if it's because of the reshoots or how they had to reconfigure things. As I was watching it this time, it felt like an outline for a really good movie. Mm-hmm. It's like, we have to get to this point and this point and this point and this happens and this happens and this happens. And there's no there, but it's strangely attenuated. So it's, you have these, it races through plot points and then it does these long interminable fights and then racing through more plot.
And I can't say, because this is a giant studio picture with an enormous budget and it's a sequel and there were lots of, you know, contracts and we can't use Brando and all of those things and we replaced the director. I can't say for sure, but I think Richard Lester is part of the problem. I think some of these performances aren't very good compared to the original movie. I think that the way it's shot feels flat. I think the producers thought they could just replace everybody and it would be fine. And it wasn't fine.
It was not fine.
My way of watching these movies is to watch and then read what I'm going to read afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I knew that there was some controversy about the directors from having read about Superman 1, but I did not read all of the back and forth and the production and blah, blah, blah until after I'd seen this. So my perspective on the movie that I watched is that it doesn't feel like a sequel to the first movie, and that's fine with me. It feels like, despite all the connective tissue and the previously on and all of that stuff, I think about this movie really differently than I think about the first movie because they're so different. This is a comic book movie, and there's nothing wrong with that. The other one was this movie, as Jason said, is about something. It has ideas. And I find that really interesting that they managed to put those two things together, despite what you know, what is clearly very uneven filmmaking. I think what's missing in terms of character in the second movie is some of the sort of charm and whimsy of the developing Christopher Reeve, Margot Kidder relationship in the first movie. And they're good performances, but for this in the second movie, but they're just different. I just don't see these movies as part of the same thing, despite the Roman numeral nomenclature. Mm. And I enjoyed this movie just as a piece of entertainment. I don't have any issues with any of the criticisms that any of you guys have raised or certainly my own, but it was fun.
Yeah.
I kind of liked it.
Oh, yeah.
I had more fun, even though I was less hard on the first movie than you guys were. I had more fun watching this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was that it's a villains, you know, the old cliche of villains you love to hate, right? Well, in this movie, I enjoyed hating those villains and they were charming and they had great dialogue and they also were malevolent. Yeah. You were, you know, legitimately scared that, you know, they had the ability to do something bad to our hero, right? So it was enjoyable. And then you actually read all the stuff about Lester and Donner and going back and forth and who wrote it and who did this and who did that. And I got exhausted reading all that. I was like, yeah. I enjoyed the movie much more before I knew all those details.
Yeah, I think I only knew about it in vague terms, but it does seem a little lifeless to me, knowing that they were originally shot together and then reshot. And maybe it's just the matter of reshooting and then having to use stuff that the previous director shot because some of the actors didn't come back, like that it feels a little bit weird tonally and it just feels flatter. You're right, Shelley. It doesn't feel like the first movie, which is funny since it was sort of originally mounted as one production. And I think that goes back to that they changed directors. And I don't think that this director, at least that's my gut feeling, is that the performances aren't quite as sharp and the movie itself just isn't quite as sharp. But also think it's a better movie. I enjoyed it more. I think it's got a lot of flaws, but it feels to me more like a complete movie. Whereas, like Erica said, the first movie is sort of these three different things all kind of shoved together. And as I like origin stories fine, Erica. It's just that sometimes I feel like the origin story movies miss the idea. This all comes back to the fact that they kept remaking the Spider-Man origin. It's like, know what I mean. You don't need to do it again. It's not the best Spider-Man story. You don't need to tell it again. Like, I love Unbreakable, which is literally an origin story of a superhero where the plot twist is that you don't know. Sorry, spoilers for Unbreakable. You don't know till the end that it's a spoiler or that it's an origin story of a superhero. That's the whole point. It's like, oh, I was watching an origin story all along. I love it when it's told well. But like that first movie, it's like part this, it's a sci-fi origin, and then it's like a kid, and then the kid leaves, and then we're in a different movie. And this is more coherent in a lot of ways, feels like the plot of a modern superhero movie, and then the execution isn't there. So you're like, all right, well, I'll just enjoy the stuff with Kidder and Reeve, who still have chemistry, and I'll enjoy Lex Luthor being a con man, and I'll enjoy the three villains wearing black and just scowling and saying ridiculous things because they're a lot of fun. And E.G. Marshall has what a toupee as the president of the United States. What is that about? There's a lot of fun stuff in this movie, and there's some good Jimmy Olsen and Perry White stuff in there. Like I think it's a good movie, even though there are parts of it that make me so mad because there's a better movie here that they didn't make because they made these weird choices.
And if you watch those early scenes of the Daily Planet with Clark and Lois, and you watch that last scene with Clark and Lois, they feel much more like the first movie relationship. There's more of that 70s movies, Robert Altman talking over one another. Those scenes are not like anything else in the movie. Yeah. It's really fascinating.
Look, movies, commercial studio movies with giant budgets, there are lots of reasons why they are the way they are. It's a miracle that any of them are any good, honestly.
And so the thing that makes me agree that Lester is probably a large part of the problem is that, you know, he came in on this as a journeyman. He was in charge of Superman 3 from the start, and wow, that's a terrible movie. And you know, the first end credit is coming soon. Superman 3 is like, is that a threat? Stop it. Stop.
Yeah, I don't think I'd go so far as to say that this is a good movie. But at least it is a movie, which I feel like the first one kind of failed on a bit. So, I think that this movie put in context is actually pretty good because, you know, as we've said, this was very, very, very early days for superhero movies. And I think they, you know, the execution wasn't great, but the overall idea, this one feels much more like a superhero movie. So I just feel to this and the first movie, a deep well of gratitude for, you know, it's not that they walked so the Avengers could run. Superman flew so that the Avengers could fly even more, I guess.
All right. So Superman flew so that Batman could drive, so that Spider-Man could swing, so that the Avengers could all stand there and glower as the camera moved around them.
And you know, speaking of origin movies, how many times do we have to see Martha Wayne's pearls fly through the air?
Speaking of origins, yes. Oh, you know, Batman's interesting. I wonder how he came to be. We know.
No idea.
Yeah.
We've seen it.
Batman began. You don't have to do it again.
Yeah, I just saw Oppenheimer and it's like, you know, we know where Oppenheimer came from. I don't need his origin story again. Jeez.
He came from Barbie land.
Is it good? Like, I liked it. I liked it, but I am also frustrated by it, I think is what I would say about this movie. I don't know. Another weird thing that I wanted to mention here, just since we're talking about Superman 2, is the existence of Superman Returns, which is a movie that I kind of like.
I haven't seen it.
And it is interesting because it is do they call them sidequels now? I don't even know. It is a movie from 2006. This is the Brandon Routh Superman movie, Superman Returns, which
I'm excited.
Didn't do very well, but like I kind of liked it. But the premise of Superman Returns is essentially, let's forget about Superman 3 and Superman 4 and Supergirl. Done. No problem. And instead, let's do a sequel to Superman 2. And that's fascinating, right? Like, because the next two movies in this series, or three if you include the Supergirl movie, not that good. They're not so good. They're like, these are the gems, folks. Yeah. It gets worse. It gets way worse from here. But Superman Returns, an interesting idea to say, like, we love those first two Superman movies. Anyway, let's do something that has that kind of vibe. And I'm fascinated by that, that somebody said, let's just wind it back to Superman 2 and go from there instead of talking about those other movies or rebooting the series, as they eventually did. They made this one movie that is just picked off of Superman 2. I'm fascinated by it. I kind of want to do an episode about it. However, I'm also creeped out a little bit by the fact that it's a Bryan Singer movie that stars Kevin Spacey.
Oh dear!
Now, see, that's too much. Kevin Spacey was in it. I was so excited about, like, Brandon Routh is so great.
Yeah.
Now so perhaps that's appropriate.
It's a director and an actor with serious sexual assault charges against them in the movie, and it's like but I do kind of like it, but I'm not sure I want to cast a spotlight on it. But I am fascinated by the idea that it literally is like, hey, what if we literally made a sequel to Superman 2? Forget about Superman 3 and 4. What if we just did that and they cast Brandon Routh, who's, I think, a pretty good Superman, and they explore the Lois and Clark relationship, which goes to some interesting places. And James Marsden is in it as Lois's boyfriend, and it's like, oh, jealousy.
Okay, there's another one in the pro column,
right?
Like, I'm weighing it back and forth.
Parker Posey's in it. Frank Langella is, and it's actually a good cast. It's like maybe Erica we'll watch it. Maybe we'll.
Haven't seen it. I'd probably join in.
It's an interesting idea, but it's from 2006. So they literally, it was 26 years later. They're like, remember that 26-year-old movie? Let's do that. Like, okay, let's do that. Let's see what happens. So fascinating that it lived in the minds of those filmmakers to the point where they picked up the gauntlet from Superman 2. And we're like, forget all those other movies. We're going back to Superman 2 and we're going to start there. It's interesting. Interesting idea. Anyway. Any final thoughts about Superman 2 before we wrap this one up?
I just like that it had both ideas and comic book aspects, and that despite the many flaws in the movie, they seemed to work well, and it neither seemed to overwhelm the other. And that's a little bit difficult to do, especially given the writing issues that this movie had, given the number of people whose paw prints were on it one way or another. So, and as I say, it's a fun movie despite all its many troubles.
Yeah. I came off of the last movie going like, I didn't like that movie. I don't think that movie was very good. I did not have that feeling with Superman 2. I was like, I have lots of issues with this movie, but I enjoyed it. And I had a fun time watching it. Somebody in the chat room pointed out, by the way, and I think this is right. The fact that Superman, as Superman, goes back to the diner and beats up the mean trucker.
No, I love that.
I was just going to bring that up.
Erica, he gets his comeuppance, and that's fun, but also, is that Superman?
That's not. No,
I mean, honestly,
that's not
to me, I felt
Boy
like
Scout.
that was, and again, this is sort of headcanon, but the idea that being human for a while actually changed him and infected him as Superman, so that he was left with enough pettiness to be able to go back and teach that guy a lesson, which, I mean, in the end, that is doing something for the greater good, because that guy has been harassing people for a long time.
At that diner.
And Superman goes back.
The only harm is
to
the owner of the diner, who I wish Clark would have left a lot of wad of 20s or something.
Well, he handed him a wad of cash. Oh, yeah, yeah. He was like, this is for the damage,
good on you,
sir.
Clark. Good on you.
And the waitress grabs it out of the cook's hand.
Yeah, right.
Yes, which is funny. So like, I feel like Superman being the straight up Superman who's not petty would still want to go back and make sure that guy is not a threat to the people around him anymore. So that's cool. And I can absolutely understand people having an issue with the petty and violent way that he does it. And to me, the reason that it worked for me is because he spent part of this movie and the most emotional part of it for him, I think, happened in this diner, discovering the fact that he was not invulnerable anymore, which, again, that doesn't make any sense, but that's the way it happened in the movie. So he's going back to the place where that happened, and sort of like, this is his catharsis from that.
So he's still sort of like poisoned by his humanity in this moment. Yep. He hasn't shaken off all of the stink of being an ape.
See, the thing that bugged me about it is it's kind of a weird placement. because you want Clark and Lois to have the emotional beat that's the end of the movie, right? They're the important characters. This guy isn't important. But what if, you know, you can keep him going back and being petty. You could actually have him go back and threaten and scare the guy without actually beating him up or causing any damage. That would have been interesting. But or to get close to causing damage. And that's when he realizes, oh, I'm not quite sure. Right. And Lois can't. This isn't right for Lois either. And I have to go back and fix that. Okay. I think that might have been a better placement. I don't know. But yeah, it bugs me because he's the big blue Boy Scout.
Right, he's supposed to just be good. And yeah, Erica's headcanon is very much like, well, he was still a little bad because he was still a little bit human and he hadn't worked all that out yet. And Steve in the chat room who mentioned this does not accept your headcanon, Erica. So that's just
that is entirely fair. Absolutely.
Anything else about Superman 2 we haven't talked about?
My final thought is that like just the act of talking about this, as often happens, has sort of, I think, crystallized for me. This is not my era of movie making. I was interested in sort of seeing how this era took on superheroes. So that's why I'm here. And I was kind of bored through a lot of this movie. Like I recognize that it's not as janky as the first one, but I just kind of didn't care enough. And I was sort of, you know, looking at my watch being like, is this movie still going? And I didn't do that as much in the first movie. And I only just now realized the reason for that is because the first movie kept changing what it was doing. And I felt like I was watching a new movie every 25 minutes or something like that. So I found it sort of less boring, but I still think this is a better movie. However, I don't actually want to watch either one of them ever again.
Well, and I think Donner is a more interesting director visually, and Lester is maybe a little more cerebral, depending on some of his films. I don't think he ever should have directed a superhero film. But, you know, because, yeah, I it does not hold up to my memories of it. I did enjoy it. I still kind of like it. But it's not the, oh, this was the great film I saw the summer of 1980.
Yeah.
I think I saw better films.
I had so many feelings about that, about the first movie. And I just, it is so much. I have so many fewer of those feelings about this movie, I guess is what I'm saying. Like this one, I feel like lived up to my memory a lot more than the first one did.
Mm. Yeah. The first one, I remember enjoying it a lot. When I did watch it a couple of years ago, I was like, all right, you know, and yeah, it's like three parts of a season of TV. But I didn't look away, right? I was watching it. Whereas this, I had my phone out. I was looking things up. I went in the kitchen and made dinner for a few minutes for one of the boys. You know, it didn't hold me, but I like it. I think because it's the dialogue. It's not the visual.
Yeah, and some of the actors and the stuff with the villains is fun. They're just fun. It's nice to have villains who are interesting and not just. And yeah, they're weird. They don't really understand because they're aliens and they behave strangely and they don't care. And then they get the idea that, oh, Jor-El's son, aha, revenge, right? Like they're all just, they're very weird and heightened and fun in a way that, again, not to impress our like modern superhero sensibilities, but I feel like we've learned over the years of what makes a good superhero movie villain and a bad superhero movie villain. And boring is what you don't want to be. And they are not boring.
And but then even then, it's like, okay, let's have this long sequence where they're flying with Lex and Lois to the Fortress of Solitude, and they're still flying, and now they're flying over terrain, and
it's boring.
They're still flying.
We hired a helicopter. We got to use it.
Yeah, we got to use it. We got all this location footage.
We spent all of that money. All right, that is going to wrap up Superman 2, although, yeah, maybe we'll make a little pact and we'll watch Superman Returns and we'll just be apologetic about who made it. I don't know. I'm sort of fascinated to go revisit that now. Anyway, that will be for another time. I would like to thank my panelists for being on this episode and taking me with them on this journey to Superman 2, two straight Superman movies. Eric Ensign, thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here. I think I'm going to have to go and get some KFC fries now.
Okay. It's because of that product placement.
Sorry. Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yes. Just stay away from the Marlboros.
yeah. You got it.
David J. Lohr, thank you.
finally, President of Australia.
Yeah. Of all places. And it's out of the way. And Shelley Brisbane, thank you.
Thank you. Somebody just came up to me and gave me a kiss, and now I don't remember the last hour.
Oh.
Oh, no.
It's all for the best. Don't you worry about it. It's all for the best. We have your interests at heart here. We made the decision for you,
well,
but we have your
that.
Interests at heart. Indeed. All right, and thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. We will see you next time.